So we have a good number of people at the dentist for the exam, so I'll return them, regardless of when people actually get done with them, I'll turn them in next time, and then we'll have a don't ask, don't tell policy, right? So you can get your exam back, and we don't have to worry about other people sneaking answers. Your good answers. So what we talked about last time is magnetic materials, and it's all very analogous to what we were doing with polarization, right? So for polarization, we define the net dipole moment, add up the atomic dipoles for the material, and usually there'll be a fair amount of disalignment, so this isn't just multiplying the number of particles, but so we get the polarization, and because that stuff is charged, it's gonna make an electric field. It's gonna make things more complicated. Not only do we have to worry about the charges that we know about, we have to know about the charges that are as a result of the material being polarized. And what we found was that, in fact, it was pretty simple. We could treat polarized material as if it were charge that had this charge density distribution and this surface charge distribution. Kind of surprising that we could take something that is made out of dipoles and find equivalent charges that would work just as well. And since we know how to figure out electric fields from charges, we were good. Turned out useful to define this auxiliary field D, which was just the right combination of E and P so that its divergence didn't depend on the existence of the bound charge. It only cared about the free charge. The cost was that the curl of D wasn't zero the way the curl of the electric field was zero, but at least the divergence only depended on normal stuff. For linear materials, I at least defined my chi to include an epsilon naught. The book didn't, but no big deal. Result was a linear relationship between the auxiliary field D and kind of the real field E. So magnetic fields are kind of totally different from electric fields. So there really shouldn't be any expectation that it would work just as well, but it pretty much does. So if we have lots of atomic dipoles, we can add them up and talk about the net dipole moment per volume, and we call that the magnetization, capital M. And we found that that was equivalent to currents that were flowing that were given by the curl of M, and a surface current that was given by M cross N. And I don't know, just to kind of wrap your mind around this, if we had a uniformly magnetized rod like this, since it's uniform, the curl would be zero, so there wouldn't be any volume currents flowing. If we look about at the cylindrical edge, the normal would be going out and M is going up, so if you take the cross product, we have a surface current that's going around like that. And of course, nothing is happening at the top or bottom because there M and N are in the same direction and the cross product is going to be zero. So this uniformly magnetized material was equivalent to a solenoid. And there's kind of a way of understanding that. The same way we understood what was happening with the dielectrics is that we had all of these little dipoles, plus minus things. And if we had material, the internal plus and minuses were canceling, and so we kind of only got effects on the boundaries in typical situations. And the same sort of thing applies to these atomic dipoles. They are little currents that are going around, and if they are uniform and unchanging, what we're going to get is a cancellation here between the current going this way and the current going that way. So net-net, the only effective current that we're going to have is going to be around the boundary. Okay, so it seems like God has been nice to us in order to make these nice relationships. But there they are. It works pretty much the same. It's still a little bit messy, so we've got curls as opposed to divergences, but I would say unexpectedly nice. So then in analogous to the D field, we can put together the H field, which is going to ignore the magnetization current. So the B field does care about all the current, both the current, I'll call it the free current that's flowing in wires, and the magnetization current, that is these atomic circuits And we go through the math, and we can make this H field whose curl just depends on the free currents. And by Ampere's law, that means we can make this version of Ampere's law, which doesn't care about the bound currents. It says that the loop integral of H dot dl just cares about the enclosed free current. Just as we could make a Gauss's law form that D only cared about the enclosed free charges. So we can proceed along the same lines, although in some sense it's not as useful as it is for dielectrics. We can talk about the magnetization being proportional to the H field, and do kind of notice this little, these little slight differences, right? So here D was involved with E plus P, and here we see that H is involved with B minus M. And in this situation, we connected the polarization to the real field E, and here we're connecting the magnetization to the auxiliary field H. So there are these slight differences, but in the end, we're going to have the real field as a multiple of the auxiliary field as opposed to the other way around. One pretty common occurring situation is where there are no free currents, things like permanent magnets, in which case the curl of H is going to be zero. And if the curl of something is zero, we can make a scalar potential, something like voltage. But the divergence of H isn't going to be zero. The divergence of B is zero, but the divergence of H isn't going to be zero because H involves M. So what we're going to have is monopole density, fake monopoles. And we have a volume monopole density, and we have a surface monopole density. And we can think about the same thing again now in a different way. So if we have a uniform magnetization, since it's uniform, there's going to be no volume monopole distribution. But there is going to be m dot n at the top, where we're going to have a positive set of monopoles, and we're going to have m dot n being negative on the bottom. So we're going to get a negative set of monopoles. And we're going to get an H field that looks a whole lot like a capacitor. Okay, so we can think about this thing like a solenoid, or we can think about it like a capacitor. Seems like two pretty different objects, but it does work, in fact, either way. And if we actually want this scalar potential, this is our friend, the solid angle. But if we want to get it, we can integrate it up from the pole densities, either the volume pole densities or the surface pole densities, just fine. Okay, and we talked kind of briefly about various types of magnetic material, and what I just said, I'll repeat. Mostly, stuff doesn't matter. Chi is so small that it plays no important role. It turns out that for most materials, chi is small and negative, and for some materials, chi is small and positive. For the materials that you think about as being attracted to a magnet, so-called ferromagnetic materials, for those, chi is huge, thousands, millions, and we have a variety of kind of special behaviors. It's really nonlinear. The magnetization is broken up into little pieces called domains, where we have basically 100% polar magnetization, but in varying directions. We've got nonlinearity and hysteresis and all that good stuff. So all of this linear theory doesn't really apply. See again? So hysteresis is where the results depend on the history. And the particular example, I think, kind of makes perfectly good sense if you think about it. If we have some magnetized material that is broken up into little bits and pieces, if I apply a magnetic field in one direction, I can get this domain to rotate so that its stuff is pointed in that direction. And if I now eliminate that magnetic field, this guy is going to have a probability of getting stuck. It's going to remain polarized even though the thing that caused it is no longer there. So if we make a graph of the magnetization versus, and typically people use H as opposed to B, what we're going to find is that as we ramp up that current, the thing gets magnetized, but as we ramp down the current, we end up with remnant magnetization. And only when we run the current backwards do we reduce the magnetization back to zero, and if we run the current backwards more, we saturate in the other direction, and then we can run it forward, and we get something like that, which is called the hysteresis loop. So what you get depends on the history, right? So just knowing that you have this particular value of current flowing doesn't tell you what the magnetization is. It depends on how you got there. So hysteresis is when stuff depends on the time ordering. And where we ran into this in 370 was in heating. When you apply a heater to an object, it's always going to be a little bit cooler than the heater. As you ramp the heater down, it's always going to be a little bit hotter than the heater. So just knowing that the heater is at some particular level doesn't tell you the temperature. You have to know whether it was recently increasing in temperature or recently decreasing in temperature. More questions? Well, you know what's got to come next, right? So there are two keeper things in this class, right? One is the R minus R prime stuff, that we figure out these fields by looking at the distance between where we're observing it and where the source is. And the other one is our friend Laplace. So we just got to work some Laplace problems in order to feel like we're doing our job. And we're all set to deal with Laplace for the case of the H field, because the curl of H is equal to zero in the absence of free currents, and that's all the problems we're going to be dealing with today. There are no free currents flowing, and so the curl of H is going to be zero, which allows us to make something like a voltage. The divergence of H is not going to be zero, which is going to mean we're going to have the equivalent of typically surface pole charges that are given to us by the magnetization dotted into N. And so typically the divergence of H is going to be zero except on the surface. And since H is equal to minus grad phi, if we take the divergence of minus grad phi, we're going to get the minus the Laplacian of phi, and that's going to be zero in the material. So as usual, we're going to have inside solutions and outside solutions, and we're going to be interested then in how we connect things up between those two boundaries. So that then leads to the topic of boundary conditions. What has to be the same between two boundaries? So if we have two materials, right, so material one and material two, what's the relationship between the H field and the B field in material one compared to the H field and the B field in material two? And let's start off by thinking about the case where there's no free current. And actually, it's not so much J. I'm concerned about actual surface currents flowing on this boundary. So let's start off by dealing with the simple case where there are no surface currents, no free surface currents flowing. And that means that the curl of H is going to be zero every place. And that means if we make an Ampérian loop, kind of like that, the loop integral of H dot dl is going to be zero. And for this loop here, we're going to get H, and let me call this direction the tangent direction. Here we're going to get H times T times L. When we go the other way, we're going to get minus the H, this is in region one, we're going to get minus the tangential component of H times L. Those things all have to add up to zero. So what we learn is that the tangential component of H has to be continuous around that boundary. What do we do if there is a current flowing? And the book has formulas that you can use, but I usually find those formulas difficult to use, and I usually rerun the argument from scratch when I'm in that situation. So if there is a current, a free current that is flowing, so let's say it's flowing out of the page, along this boundary, out of the page, then what we're going to get here is the the free current that's enclosed by that loop, and that's going to be, I'll call it K times L. So now what we're going to get is that H1 tangential minus H2 tangential is equal to that free current that's flowing up in a perpendicular direction. If you asked me how the tangential component is going to be in the along the line that is vertical from this piece of paper, if I make an Amperian loop like that, it encloses no current. And so the component of H that's into or out of the page on this side has to equal the component of H that's into or out of the board on this side. Okay, so surface currents affect tangential components of H in a plane that's perpendicular to those currents. And that can be written as a vector equation. The book does it, but I find those equations not useful. I rerun this argument every time I want to find out how H changes around a boundary. And you've got a homework problem like that, where you're finding how H changes at a boundary, with all of the complications that are possible. Okay, so that's H. How about B? Well, for B, the magic equation is that the divergence of B is always zero. That's a forever equation. And if we make a Gaussian pillbox, right? So this is a pillbox. I'm going to make the side arbitrarily thin. And I know then that the surface integral of B dot the normal times the area has to be zero. On this top surface, I'm going to get, and let me call this the normal direction. So on the top surface, the normal direction that I've defined is the same as the normal for the surface, so I'm going to get B2 times the area in the normal direction. On the bottom surface, I'm going to get the normal for the surface is in the opposite direction as the normal I've chosen for the overall surface. So I'm going to get this minus sign. And I'm going to get the B field times that area. And those things have to add up to zero. So the result is that there's no change in the normal component of B. And that's a forever equation. Right? The tangential component depends on the existence or non-existence of surface currents, free surface currents, real surface currents, currents that you can take on or off with a battery. The normal component of B is always going to be conserved. Okay, so I hope you're getting tired of solving these problems because they're all the same. So let's solve the problem of a some sort of magnetic material that has a magnetic a magnetic constant, the same thing as a dielectric constant K, and outside we've got vacuum, and we're going to put this guy in a uniform H field, a field that is uniform at infinity. And by the arguments we've just said, we can write H, there are no free currents here, we can write H as minus the gradient of some scalar potential. And there's going to be no pole density, so the divergence of H is going to be zero. So we get that the Laplacian of that thing has to be zero. And so we can use all of our favorite stuff about Laplace's equation. If we call this the z-axis, then we have a problem that is symmetric around the z-axis, and we know what the general solution to Laplace looks like in those cases, right? It's powers of R and Legendre polynomials. So for all of the usual reasons, we can write the, it would be nice, I guess I can still call it scalar potential. It's just like voltage. I have a tendency to want to call it voltage, to use a familiar name as opposed to an unfamiliar name. So inside, we can write this as the sum of some unknown coefficients, r to the n, pn. And outside, we've got the inverse powers. And we need to have something that's going to make that constant H field at infinity. And remember the trick that Z is, of course, R cosine theta, and cosine theta is P1. So this is very similar to an A1 sort of term. Okay, so what I've written down satisfies Laplace's equation. So it's going to have the curl of H being 0 and the divergence of H being 0, so it all looks good. But we have to find these currently unknown coefficients. And for that, we use the boundary conditions. And the boundary conditions are there's no free currents flowing here, so the tangential component of H has to be continuous, and that's equivalent to the scalar potential being constant across that boundary. So if I take phi on the inside and I evaluate it at the boundary, I have to get the same thing I would get using the outside solution and applying it on the boundary. So the other thing I know is that the normal component of B has to be constant across this boundary. And of course, the normal component is the radial component. And I can get the radial component of B by taking mu naught times K times the radial component of H. And I can get the radial component of H from minus the derivative with respect to R of phi. So what I'm going to have is that minus mu naught, k is 1 outside, the derivative with respect to phi outside, evaluated at the boundary, has to be the same thing on the inside, right? Where there I have mu naught, k, derivative with respect to r of phi on the inside, and then with a minus sign. Okay, old hat stuff. So the mu naughts and the minus signs cancel, and we have a relationship between the derivatives of these phi. So if two vectors are the same, and remember we think of these things as vectors with basis vectors given by these pn's, if two vectors are the same, then the coefficients in all of the unit vector directions have to be the same. So what we can conclude, at least for n not equal to 1, from the top equation is that an r to the n has to equal cn over r to the n plus 1. Right? So all I'm saying is that the coefficient of pn has to be the same on both sides of this equation. For n equals 1, I have to be a little bit careful because there's this hidden coefficient. So the coefficient on the right-hand side is still a1 r to the 1, and we still certainly have the c1 over the r squared, but in addition we have a coefficient that is minus h0 times r. Okay, so for n not equal to 1, two unknowns, it's homogeneous, meaning there's no constant term, and you know how that's probably going to work out. All of those are going to turn out to be 0. Okay, so let's take a look at the second equation. So the second equation, if we cancel out those minus signs, said that k times the derivative with respect to r of phi on the inside had to equal the derivative with respect to r of phi on the outside. And these things are pretty easy to calculate. What we're going to have then is k times the sum of n a n evaluating at r equals capital R, and here we're going to get minus summation of n plus 1 c n over r to the n plus 2. And we also have that term from the constant magnetic field, which was minus h naught P1, once we take the derivative with respect to R and evaluate it at capital R, because it was just R to the 1. Okay, so two vectors are the same. The x components have to be the same. The y components have to be the same. The z components have to be the same thing, except these, oops, I dropped all my pn's. These pn's are playing the role of unit vectors in this infinite dimensional space. So it has to be the case, if n doesn't equal to 1, then we have to have k n a n r to the n minus 1. That's the coefficient of pn on this side of the equation, has to equal the coefficient of pn on the other side of the equation, which is minus n plus 1 cn divided by r to the n plus 2. So for n not equal to 1, we've got two equations and two unknowns. They're homogeneous, and they have the trivial solution that an equals cn equals 0. So we only have to worry about the case n equals 1. So for n equals 1, we've got k, n is 1, we got a 1, r to the 0 isn't there, and on the other side of the equation, we've got minus 2 c1 divided by r cubed and minus h naught. Okay, so let's kind of bring back, let's rewrite this with all the unknowns on one side of the equation. So we've got k a1 plus 2 c1 divided by r cubed is equal to minus h naught. And the equivalent equation here, if I divide it through by r, is going to be a1 minus c1 over r cubed is equal to minus h naught. Okay, two equations, two unknowns. Take your favorite way of solving it. I'm going to multiply this bottom equation by 2 and then add them, because then the 2's are going to cancel out. So I'm going to get k plus 2 times a1 wants to equal minus 3 h naught. So a1 is going to equal minus 3 over k plus 2 times h naught. One check of all of this is, if this sphere is just made out of vacuum, there should be no effect. And if I put in k equals 1, then I get a1 is equal to minus h naught, which is just what the electric field, or just what the magnetic, just what the H field was outside of the boundary. Once I've got a1, I can plug it back in to figure out what c is. And I don't know, I guess I'll do it with the bottom equation. So a1 is minus 3 over k plus 2 times h naught. Let me bring that h naught over to the other side of the equation, and that all has to equal c1 over r cubed. And I can put these guys together. That is to say, seek a common denominator that is k plus 2. So what I'm going to get then is k minus 1 over k plus 2 times h naught is equal to c1 over r cubed. So when k equals 1, there's no dipole term. The only term we have in the outside solution is the constant magnetic field, and there's no effect. Okay, if k is more than 1, then we're going to produce a dipole magnetic field from this particular term. And I guess also, if k is more than 1, notice that the H field is going to be reduced from what it was on the inside. Okay, so there's a useful analogy, I hope, for figuring out how these things work. So what we have here is that the B field is equal to mu naught times k times the H field, and this is the guy that has divergence 0. And we also have the equation that the current that's flowing is G times the electric field. And this is the guy that has divergence 0. So we can kind of make equivalent problems out of electric fields and magnetic fields and kind of understand how things are going to work. So if we had a
conductor, a good conductor, copper, that was sitting in seawater and a current was flowing this away, what we expect is that a lot of that current is going to want to go through the easy conductor of copper. So as a result, we're going to get more current in the copper than we had outside of the copper. And so what that means is that under these circumstances, we're going to be sucking in B field when we have strong magnetic materials. And the effect is really pretty significant because K is 1,000 or 1,000,000 or something like that. So we can have a fair amount of magnetic flux diverted to the inside of that magnetic material. Because it, just as current wants to flow through a good conductor, magnetic field wants to be in high K material. Very analogous. Okay, so let me, with that in mind, let me talk about a problem which is a mess, and you should have a handout on it. Handouts were over there, and I should have a Xerox of it. So there's an important, using this analogy, imagine the following situation. We have a magnetic field, and we have an experiment that we surround with highly magnetic material. And what we should expect is the magnetic field would love to be in this magnetic material. And so as a result, there would be relatively small current, as it were, that would be flowing through that low conductivity material. The current would want to flow through the copper as opposed to the seawater. And so we would have a reduced magnetic field. Inside this shield. So this is called magnetic shielding, and it's technologically a pretty important thing. So there is stuff called mu metal, which has a K that is on the order of 1,000,000. And if you want your experiment to be relatively free of the Earth's magnetic field, which we can't do a lot about, you can surround it with mu metal, and the magnetic field on the inside will be typically a factor of K or so, less than the magnetic field on the inside. Okay, so using mu metal shields in order to protect television screens, for example, from stray magnetic fields. So, I don't know, so one very common old-fashioned example of this is old cathode ray television screens. Of course, how they work is they have electron beams that are directed at the screen to light up particular pixels. But if there's a magnetic field, the electron isn't going to go where you're hoping it's going to go. The picture will be misaligned. So television tubes are always surrounded to the extent that's possible with mu metal shields to keep the Earth's magnetic field from interrupting with the pre-calculated flow of the electrons. Okay, so proving that, so I hope I've convinced you qualitatively that since current wants to flow through copper as opposed to seawater, we should have this sort of effect. But showing it is kind of a mess. And it's really the first situation that we've had that has had multiple, three in this case, situations, materials 1, 2, and 3. And I don't aim to go through all of the details, but I do point at the bottom thing, which says that the magnetic field is actually down by a factor of K compared to what it would be outside. So this is the ratio of the magnetic field outside to the magnetic field inside. So you can see that outside it's a factor of K bigger. These A's and B's are ratios of the size of the shield. And I hope it's clear, if you make that shield really thin, it's not going to be very effective, right? So even copper, if you make it, you know, a millimeter thick, isn't going to attract a whole lot of current. So So we get 1 minus the ratio of those two. So if A is substantially smaller than B, that's the situation under which we get noticeable amount of shielding. If we make our mu metal shield too thin, it won't be effective. Okay, so what's left is to crank through these equations. And most of this is kind of no surprise. So outside here in region 1, we've got exactly the sort of situation we just talked about. And all the way on the inside, maybe I should comment. The particular case I've decided to deal with here is cylinders as opposed to spheres. So instead of having Legendre polynomials, I've got cosine of n thetas. Right, so you know that they work exactly the same. So all the way inside, I've got exactly what we had before all the way inside. But in this intermediate layer, I don't have the ability to rule out either the positive powers of R or the negative powers of R. So I have to have both. Okay, so that's kind of new. Usually we had one or the other because we either had a region that included infinity or it included the origin. Now we've got this region 2, which includes neither, and so we have to include both possibilities. Okay, so what we have to do now is at every boundary, at the boundary between 1 and 2, and at the boundary between 2 and 3, we have to equate the terms that say that the tangential component of phi is continuous and that the normal component of B is continuous. So what we're going to get then is equations that relate A and D and E, and then another set of equations that relate D and E to C. So instead of having 2 equations and 2 unknowns, we're going to have 4 equations and 4 unknowns, and it quickly becomes kind of a mess. So I don't know. I'm not going to go through all of this algebra solving those 4 equations and 4 unknowns, but I hope you can see it works, aside from being twice as complicated, it works exactly the same as it worked before. We're doing exactly the same sort of things, saying that the scalar potential has to agree and that k times the radial derivative of it has to agree. Just gives us more equations and more unknowns and a lot of algebra that cranks down to this final result. Okay, and I agree, technologically this is important. It means that we can make H inside small roughly by a factor of K, which might be 1,000,000 or 1,000, as long as we make the shield moderately thick. Okay. Everyone's game? Okay, so what else can we do with Laplace's equation? Well, another problem we solved with the dielectric, and it was useful, and this one will also be useful in the future, was the problem of a unified polarized sphere. So now I'm going to think about what happens if I have a sphere that has a constant magnetization. And we can already kind of work out what this is going to mean. Because the magnetization is constant, there isn't going to be any volume pole density. On the other hand, there is going to be a surface pole density that's given by m dot n. And the normal here is just the radial, and the magnetization is all in the k direction. So what we've got is the magnetization k dot r, and k dot r is just cosine theta. So we have a charge distribution. So if here's the equator, we've got strong positive charge that is getting to zero near the equator, and then we've got strong negative charge. And of course, it's azimuthally symmetric. And just qualitatively, we know what's going to happen, right? We're going to have then an H field that is going to connect the positive and the negative charges. So we're kind of expecting dipole on the outside and generally speaking, downward H-field on the inside. And it's going to turn out that the H-field is actually constant on the inside. Okay, so this is equivalent to a problem where we have a surface charge density on the outside. And typically that meant, for example, back in polarization terms, that the change in the normal component of D was equal to the free charge density. And it's going to work the same way here, except now we've got this monopole density, fictitious monopole density on the surface that's going to lead to discontinuities in the radial component of H. Okay, so the usual stuff applies. Because the magnetization is constant, there's no monopole density, so the divergence of H is zero. The curl of H is always zero in the absence of free charges, so we're going to be able to solve Laplace's equation, where the H field is going to be minus the gradient of phi. And we're going to have inside solutions. Inside, we can't have any r to the negative power sort of stuff because they would blow up. So we're only going to have the A sort of terms. And outside, we can only have the C type terms. We don't have any constant magnetic field, right? Because this is the whole story. So it's going to at least start out to be pretty much the same as the previous problem. We have to have the tangential component of H continuous, and that means that the phis have to match. So we have to have phi inside equaling phi outside when we're on the boundary. And when two vectors are the same, the xyz components have to be the same, so we quickly reduce this to an r to the n has to equal cn over r to the n plus 1. Kind of no surprise there. Okay, so let's be a little bit more careful with the derivative equation. So what we have to have is that the change in the normal component of H is equal to the monopole density, the surface monopole density, which is just m cosine theta. And what I mean here is, of course, the radial component of H in the outside, which what did I call region 2, minus the H, well, what did I call it outside, but I started to call it 1 and 2. And these H's are, of course, going to be just minus derivatives with respect to R of the corresponding in and out solutions. So the minus signs kind of switch things around. So what I'm going to have is that derivative with respect to R of phi on the inside minus the derivative with respect to R on the outside has to equal m times, and just for good practice, remember that cosine theta is p1. So what we've got here is the summation of, and this is true at the boundary. That's where this surface charge is. So this is going to give us n times an r to the n minus 1 minus, it's going to end up being a plus, n plus 1 cn divided by r to the n plus 2. All of those times Pn has to equal mP1. Okay, and you can see how it's going to work. For n not equal to 1, we're going to get a homogeneous equation for the ans and cns. So we have two homogeneous linear equations which have a trivial solution of A equals C equals 0. So N equals Cn equals 0. So the action all happens when N equals 1. So for N equals 1, we've got, and again, as I'm equating the coefficients of P1 now, so I'm going to have An R to no power plus 2 C1 over R cubed has to equal M. And that needs to go along with our earlier equation, this guy here. And just for good measure, let me divide that through by R. So it is saying that, oops, this was a 1. I'm not sure if I said that. So this is going to be A1 minus C1 over R cubed is equal to 0. Okay, two equations, two unknowns. I'm going to solve this guy by multiplying the bottom guy by 2 and adding. So I'm going to get 3 A1 is equal to M. So A1 is going to be 1/3 of M. And just for a second, let's see what that means. So that means that phi on the inside is exactly equal to 1/3 mz, right? Because z is equal to rp1. And this is, of course, our A1 term. And that means that h on the inside, well, it's easy to take the gradient of something now that I know that it's z. It's going to be minus 1/3 m in the k direction. So as we expected, this inside the field, the H field is going down, and it has a value that is 1/3 M. Outside, we expect a dipole field, which is a C2 sort of term. So we're all set to calculate that. We can just plug our value for A back in. Plug it back into this guy here. So what we're going to get then is that C1 over R cubed is equal to 1/3 of M. And I'm going to kind of plug and chug this guy around a little bit. So let me bring the R cubed up. And boy, if I had a 4 pi here, it would look a lot more familiar. So now what it looks like is I have the volume of the sphere times the dipole moment per volume. That's what M is, all over 4 pi. Right? So if I take the total volume and I multiply it by the dipole per volume, I should get the kind of the total dipole. So that's producing then an H field that is equal to M cosine theta times the P1 divided by R squared over 4 pi. And that's exactly the dipole form. So the sphere that is made up of lots of individual dipoles is exactly equivalent to a dipole that has a dipole moment that's just the total dipole moment of everything in the sphere. Right? Kind of couldn't have worked out in a simpler fashion. While we're at it, let's figure out what the B field is like. Well, outside, things are easy for the B field, right? Because outside, there's no magnetization. So the B field is just mu naught times the H field. Right? So kind of no surprise there. Inside, things are a little bit more interesting. So what we have is that B is equal to mu naught times the H field plus M. And the H field is minus 1/3 M. So this is going to be mu naught times 2/3 of M. So while the H field is down, the B field is up. And I don't know if that bothers you or not. I hope it bothers you a little bit, but not for more than the following minute. What is the case if we have a current? So if we have a current loop like this, a dipole, it's going to produce a magnetic field at its center that is up, right? So it's going to be going up and around. So it's perfectly normal to expect a magnetic field that's up. Or if you want another argument, remember that we have a surface current that is M cross the normal. So this sphere, here's the normal, the magnetization is up. If we cross those two things together, what we get is a current that is flowing around like this, parallel to the equator. So we have a bunch of loops like that. Well, of course, they're going to make a magnetic field on the inside that is going up. Okay. So we can do a kind of an infinite number of Laplace equation sorts of problems, just like normal. Although, if you think about it, there aren't too many types of Laplace problems we've actually worked, right? The constant field problem, the uniformly magnetized problem. I guess we've worked lots of problems where we had some specified charge or voltage on the surface. But mostly, it's all been the same. And it's pleasant to recognize that it's still all the same, even though we just have magnetic fields now, which have crosses all over the place, as opposed to the electric fields, which certainly are a lot simpler. So let's see where this realization that we have that the magnetic field, just like the, so currents like to be in highly conductive material. So if you have wires mixed in with air, the current will choose to go through the wire and not choose to go through the air. And the difference in conductivity between copper and air is that it's probably, I don't know, 10 to the 14th or something like that. It's huge. So there's not quite that big a difference between the K for iron, thousands or millions, and the K for air, which is just one. But in the same sort of way, the B field should like to be in iron or any ferromagnetic material. And just as we assume that the current always flowed through the wire, we're about to make the assumption that the magnetic field, the B field, always wants to be in iron. It's not super true, because as I say, the ratio of the differences in conductivity between air and copper is more than the ratio of K for air versus iron, but still pretty substantial. So what we can do now is make iron circuits. So imagine the following situation. I have some block of iron, and it doesn't have to be just iron. Just for fun, it could have a variety of different materials in here. Right, so here's one sort of material, and then there's another sort of material. One sort of material after another, and we want to try and solve what the magnetic field is going to be under these sort of situations. So we're going to put some current loops around here and see what we can conclude from this problem. So if we think about a Amperian loop, kind of like that, What we know is that if we integrate around this loop, not B, H.dl, we're going to get the free current, the currents that are flowing through this wire. So I've maybe got n turns, and each turn is has got I amps in it. Now the H field, we could calculate if we wanted to from the B field, right? The H field is equal to the B field divided by mu naught times K. And I claimed that B was always going to want to stay inside this magnetized material. But there's maybe an additional little complication that's worth talking about. I drew this thing as being a constant area. What happens if the magnetic material has a waste? What's going to happen under those circumstances? Well, if the magnetization wants to stay in that material, the magnetic field is going to have to look kind of like that. It's going to end up concentrated, going to have more B here than we have here. Because all of that magnetic field wanted to stay in that cross-sectional area. Well, what's constant? We see that B isn't constant because it's going to be concentrated. What is it that's like current? So current density has the same problem, right? So if you have a copper wire that is fat and it thins down, we're going to have the same current that's flowing through that copper wire, but the current density is going to be a lot stronger where the wire is narrower than when it's fatter. But what is it that is like current that is a constant for this problem? Well, flux, magnetic flux. So I don't think we've talked a whole lot about fluxes, but it's a pretty straightforward idea. If we have a, can be an imaginary loop, could be a real loop, it doesn't matter. So here is going to be more or less an imaginary loop in space. What I mean by the magnetic flux is think about a surface that is bounded by that loop and calculate for this surface the integral of B dot dA, where dA is the vector that satisfies the right-hand rule, right? So if I have oriented my loop that way, then I mean that the normal for this loop is that way, and we're all set. And so roughly speaking, what you probably said in 200 is the magnetic flux is the magnetic field times the area times the cosine of the angle between the normal and the area vector. But we've grown up and now we know magnetic fields aren't necessarily a constant, so we can't pull them outside of the integral. So we've got this more general formula for magnetic flux. Okay. So having magnetic flux, now we want to talk about flux tubes. So in the situation we were just talking about, we had a magnetic field that was kind of concentrated like that. So imagine following a individual magnetic field line, and what I mean, of course, by magnetic field line is go in the direction that the magnetic field is at any given point. And now imagine the surface that you would get by following a series of such lines. Okay, so this is a tube that the magnetic field is everywhere tangent to.
So far, so good.
So how does the flux compare through this surface and through this surface?
Well, Gauss's law for magnetic fields promises us that if we take the overall B dot n dA and we integrate it for the surface that's made out of this plus that, we got to get zero. And B dot dA is zero by definition for this piece of the surface. So the flux coming into this area has to equal the flux that's going out of this area. So for a flux tube, the flux has to be a constant. Because there isn't any source of there aren't any magnetic monopoles, so that the divergence of the magnetic field has to be zero. So another analogy that might help is to think about flow. If we have a fluid that is not compressible, then the amount, if this were as a wind tunnel, for example, the amount of mass that's flowing into the wind tunnel has to be the same thing as the amount of mass that's flowing through this restriction, because it can't be accumulating anyplace. There's no exit for it. Okay, so if we consider a flux tube, we can calculate the magnetic field, at least approximately, by taking the flux and dividing it by the perpendicular area of that tube. So that's kind of a 200 level approximation. Here the area is small, so the magnetic field is going to be big. Here the area is big, so the magnetic field is going to be small. Okay, and since the magnetic field loves to be in magnetic material, the boundary of this magnetic material is a flux tube. The magnetic field is not going to want to leave. It's going to want to stay inside of this tube. Okay, so if we come to our line integral now, so, I don't know, maybe it's worth repeating what we have. So what we have is what's going to be constant for this magnetic surface is the flux. And we can at least get an approximation for the magnetic field by taking the flux and dividing it by the perpendicular area. Very, very analogous to how current flows through wires, right? So same current, if you reduce the area, the current density is going to be stronger at the corresponding spot. And we know that if we add up around this loop, h dot dl, we're supposed to get the number of turns times I. And we know we can calculate h by taking b and dividing it by mu naught times k. Okay, so now's the time to put all of these pieces together. So B is the flux. So what we've got is, and the flux is a constant. So what we've got is the flux integrate around dl divided mu naught. Well, mu naught is at least a constant. If we have different materials, k will be changing. This has to equal Ni. So for each one of these little pieces, I can do this little integral, right? So I'm going to have a purple piece of this where I have the length of that segment divided by the corresponding k and the corresponding a. And then I'm going to have the next section where I have all of these sorts of things.
Okay, so let me call these things the reluctance. And you should think resistance when you hear the word reluctance. Just as when you're talking about flux, you should be thinking about current. So what we have then is that the flux times the total reluctance, the reluctance of all of the pieces that make up the circuit, that has to equal mu naught times Ni. So obviously I maximize the current if I have the smallest possible resistance. So I'm going to maximize the flux if I have the smallest possible reluctance. And I get small reluctances, of course, by having big areas and big magnetic dielectric constants. And it might be useful just to remind you about the equivalent formula for resistance. So you might remember the resistance was the resistivity times the length of the wire divided by the area. So very similar formula for resistance and reluctance, with K playing the role of the conductivity of the material. Okay, so one more step, I guess. Very commonly, people want to actually perform experiments with magnetic fields, and so they have to have a region that is not iron. We have to have a gap. And because the gap is not made of magnetic material, it's going to have a relatively large reluctance. It actually has units, but so saying it's greater than one doesn't make much sense. The reluctance of the gap is going to be maximizing. And of course, we can get the biggest possible flux by making this gap as small as possible, having it has as big an area and as short a length as possible. And we can actually use these formulas to calculate what the magnetic field would be in the gap, you know, given how many turns we had in our magnet. And maybe, well, there's always one more thing. Yes. No, I guess no. Questions? So we're pretty much done. We've got some homework to work on this sort of magnetic problem, but we're pretty much, so we have one more set of homework that's probably going to be from chapter 9, but we're pretty much done with the content.